listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
We all know about and use stereotypes, sometimes more than we want to. What happens when we relate to others through the stereotypes we carry? And what if we're treated as if we fit the stereotype, but we don't? Today's guest on Full Power Living never did fit the stereotypes applied to him and has a lot to tell us about what actually allows someone to be successful in creating the life he or she wants regardless of stereotypes that we hold or other people hold. My guest today is orthopedic surgeon Dr. Michael Charles, who is author of Too Big to Hide, Too Dark to Blend In. Welcome to Full Power Living, where we're dedicated to awakening the world to the power, importance, and mastery of human emotions. I invite you to post your comments and questions on our blogs at emotionalpro.com and also on blogtalkradio.com/FPL for Full Power Living. You can talk with me or Dr. Charles over our toll-free number, which is 888-498-0570. That's 888-498-0570. And you can sign up for Full Power Living's broadcast through subscriptions on iTunes. Dr. Mike Charles was born and raised in San Francisco, California. After high school, he was one of three U.S. citizens to become the first to receive a full academic/athletic scholarship. Canadian University, Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. He went on to receive a Master's of Medical Science at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey in Piscataway and earned his medical degree at Rutgers Medical School. And then he came back to California and interned in surgical specialties at Martin Luther King Jr. Hospital in Los Angeles. That's where he was awarded Intern of the Year for Los Angeles County Hospital. He completed his orthopedic surgery residency and then was recruited to a trauma hospital as their orthopedic specialist. And I'll just say as an aside that the recruiter was none other than my husband, neurosurgeon Robert Fink, which I learned about recently. Right now, Dr. Charles works as a consultant in the workers' compensation area as an orthopedic advisor. He takes most pride in his role as a mentor to medical students aiming to provide the same support as he received as a student, fostering bright minds and helping others comprehend their true potential in order to become better versions of themselves. He lives with his wife in Oakland, California. Dr. Mike Charles, I welcome you to Full Power Living.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. It's nice to talk to you. Well, now, you know, the first thing that strikes a person is your very interesting title on your book, Too Big to Hide, Too Dark to Blend In. And it's a novel, but it's also quite a bit autobiographical, I think. And so I wanted to know about your inspiration to write this book and what your hope is in putting it out in the world.
Well, first and foremost, the inspiration in writing the book, we have to go back to what was going on at the time in 1970 in my life as I was just coming on and looking at the world, lots of questions. It all goes back to, actually, a thing called the Jim Crow laws, the Reconstruction period, where it was mandated that racial segregation in all public facilities were be the law. And as we recall, we're talking about the American Civil War after, and to get those southern states comfortable with the northern states, they put in a few rules, as you will, that would say that, you know, whites are still superior to those newly freed people. And Jim Crow laws, which was basically another name for just a code for Negro laws, actually mandated substandard education facilities and everything for black people. So it was de jure, it was for the day, whereas in the northern states it became a de facto thing, which came into housing segregation, bank lending, job discrimination. So that was the focus of America, if you will, and we can deal. That's a whole another subject. But as I'm looking at I'm in San Francisco, looking at American history, and all these things are coming about. It also corresponded with all the race riots that were going on. All of the change, I called it in the book, a ball of confusion, because all these de facto laws were being challenged all over America, and it was coming out even more so in the race riots and other social unrest. What I hope to get out of my story is the fact that though this was unfortunately against, you know, it looked to be black unrest, it was a lot of things were being challenged. And when you look at black people, for the most part, you only thought about blacks in substandard situations and ghetto situations. You never also included the fact that blacks who were educated, or even as you look back in the history, the whole thing about being a free person, that is a non-slave, as long as you were black or had that, you were, you know, a Negro, you were fit in that category. And so my story, first and foremost, said that our protagonist, even though he wasn't fit in that category, he had to deal with it. So the multifaceted portion of the black experience in America comes to effect with my book, and him having to deal with the fact that he is a large black person, and whether this is a stigma or to be used against him or for him is hopefully developed in the story.
Yes, you know, I remember talking with some mothers who were black about raising their sons, and they told me many of the ways that they taught their sons so that they would not stand out, so that they would be safe. And that's really remarkable when I even just read your title, and I also know that you fit that description as well, as does your protagonist in your book. And so you have to do something different. You can't fade into the woodwork. You have to conduct yourself in such a way that you can still be a full human person and reach your full potential without being able to disappear, as it were.
Correct. Well, there's no disappearance. We talk about people who are not quote mainline white. We mentioned the Jewish dilemma,
right?
Where they're white, but if they tell people they're Jewish, all of a sudden there might be a conflict. But that conflict may not even come about if they don't mention the fact that they're Jewish. Whereas a person of a darker hue or a different color, you don't have that option. I mean,
right.
They see you coming. They see that you are, quote, not mainstream, so to be. And you have to, first of all, get over that hurdle before you can even be heard, for the most part.
Right, right. So let me just give a little background for those of you who are listening here. Dr. Charles has written this book, and it's really a novel, and it largely addresses this whole issue of upheaval and race relations. I think at one point in the book, you say the whole world is racist. So it's the story of the protagonist, Paul, who grows up in San Francisco, and he comes from a well-heeled family. His father is an attorney, and he goes to Stanford University, but he doesn't feel a lot of meaning in his life, so he suddenly drops out and enlists in the Marines and is sent to Vietnam. And that's, at least in the book, as I read it, that's where he first encounters some of the racial stereotypes. And then he gets assigned to a medical unit under the tutelage of a Sergeant Harris. And right from the beginning, I want to read this quote, Mike. Harris has this to say: "You have a responsibility to your blackness. You have a debt to pay to your people, our ancestors, to the institutions we've already started, the ones that need to be started, to better educate, better prepare those less lucky or less fortunate, but just as deserving. I went to the same white schools as you. Shit got to change to make black people more comfortable wherever they choose to learn. But until that day comes, we don't need more jails, more Vietnams, where black soldiers viewed as cannon fodder by Paul's observation." That's my insert there. "Our world needs help, serious help. And the Lord put you here to help make that change. But for God's sake, ask the tough questions. Who am I? Am I my own man?" So what he's really saying there is that if you really want to help the world, you need to use your talents to develop your potential to go ahead and stand out. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, and this, again, we go right back into the Jim Crow laws again, where it was set up that the majority of the blacks, when they were trying to meld the nation together as one union, actually made laws where black education was substandard. They were a second class. This was the law in the southern states, and again, as I said, de facto throughout the rest of the country. So whereas Paul's ancestors left the South and was somehow able to overcome that, they did go to good schools. They did get good education. America was still a place where they would put one category over another. And some people who were from various, some well-meaning people who were raised to believe that blacks were second class or from a situation where they did not have the educational rights that other whites had, theoretically, they'd have to overprove themselves to be that they did read the book, that they were educated, and actually have to go over and above what maybe some of their other classmates who were accepted to a fact that they were from good schools had a good understanding of what was in the books, and when they already just, it was understood, so it would just flow. Whereas the black individual had to prove to the professor over and above that they understood what was being read or what was being taught. So here I created an individual who did not have that issue. His father was a lawyer. He had three other brothers who were lawyers. They were all very educated from very good schools. And somehow, Paul did not feel comfortable with just being given being different from the other blacks, and it was never really an issue or a challenge in California and his family until he actually became across a mass of people who were exposed to this situation. And again, the big point for the book is not all blacks had to struggle out of the ghetto and out of these situations that were, again, established by America to give a bootleg up for other individuals. He was there, and Sergeant Harris was telling him, you didn't have to deal with a lot of the hurdles that others here had to deal with, and we need you to educate, to help, and bring forward. And so don't be what they want you to be, another successful black person. Be a total person. Understand, look at this. It's not the world as racist, but more, what you had said, but more ethnocentric. Make it a world situation and not based on the color of your skin.
Yeah, that was so wonderful. When I was growing up, Mike, my father was in the military, and he had an African-American boss, a colonel over him, and I went to military schools, which were integrated. And then in the summers, I would spend time on my grandfather's farm in South Georgia, which was anything but integrated. And it was really, I think I early on became aware of this this schism that you're talking about, because in my most of my year, I was among people who, everybody was equal. We were all going to the same school. We were friends. We were in the same grade, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I would get to the farm, people perceived blacks as substandard, as unable to understand. I remember going with my uncle one time who was going to get people to help him pick their cotton crop. And I was shocked because my uncle even changed the way he spoke. He slowed his speech down and talked to people as if they would never be able to understand him. And it was quite shocking. And I don't know how many people are aware of that schism, but I certainly lived it. And it brought that whole issue to me as a white person, not in the same way that it came to you. Now, in your book, Paul, you said about him that here's part of what was different about him. Acceptance in Nam was no different than what he'd been familiar with throughout his life. He always was picked first or second to play on whatever team sport was being organized because his superior athletic skills gave him instant popularity, and his musical talent with his guitar added to this. So your protagonist had some ways that, the way I would see it, is that were comfortable for the people around, so it was easier for them to relate to him as a real person.
Correct. And I guess that's again, a general statement, because first acceptance is mostly a personality game. If people like how you look, how you feel, you're accepted. You're on the team.
Right.
War was the same thing. It was, you're on our team. You look like a good guy, and that sort of weaved throughout the story that people will react to him. And again, what Sergeant Harris was saying right away, you sit there, people like you. So you have a foot in the door right from there. Besides just being too big or too dark, there's a inner sense about you that people want to associate with you. And that was sort of a little underlying thing that I would use in motivational speeches, and that is the fact that be aware of your surrounding. If people incorporate you or want to be your friend, you don't have to question that. I mean, just go with the flow with that.
Yes, definitely. We're up to our first break, Mike. I want to remind you who are listening, call us on our toll-free line, 888-498-0570, so you can talk with our guest today, orthopedic surgeon Dr. Michael Charles. And we're going to be finding out more about his ideas for creating your own successful life, regardless of how others see you, when we return. You're listening to Full Power Living. We'll be right back. Know that emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years? Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us, four things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives, as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free emotional mastery teleseminar.
Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. First of all, thank you for helping us with our mission since 2004 of transforming our world through understanding the importance, mastery, and power of human emotions. We enjoy bringing you unique, in-depth programs, drawing attention to emotions as tools with which we've been equipped in order to better navigate our lives. Also, please visit emotionalpro.com, where you can download your copy of my free list of the signals of seven everyday emotions that can help you to move toward mastery over the emotions that come up in your life. And while you're there, sign up to be on our mailing list so we can send you our biweekly newsletter telling you about our programs. For example, next week I'm talking with Maureen St. Germain about our higher self, why you want to be in contact with your higher self, simple ways to get there, and how to understand what you're being told by your higher self. So be here at 9 a.m. Pacific time, that's noon Eastern, next Thursday for that discussion. Our topic today is Too Big to Hide, Too Dark to Blend In, the title of a novel recently published by author and orthopedic surgeon Dr. Mike Charles. Mike, I wanted to ask you before we get back into our regular line of questions, what extra personal challenges did you find being too big to hide created for you, especially as you were attempting to become a mature man and identify your life's purpose and move ahead with full power? Was there anything that really stood out to you that, you know, I really can't hide, I'm going to have to bite the bullet and do something here?
Well, the one major issue was I found out, again, from my professors, my mentor, I challenged my father had this thing of saying, I never understood it totally until I was older and understood it. He said, well, I was one of four children. And he said, you know, you weren't my smartest child, but you sure had a lot of questions. And and I would question, and from what I understood, that questioning was more so that I was an independent thinker. I made up my mind as to what my investigation of the situation was until I was satisfied with an answer that I wanted. So that was another issue, in a sense. And what my professor, Dixon, first talked about was the fact that you're going to be a marked man because you're speaking your mind. The individual that you're challenging has to deal with you because everybody sees you in the audience or in the classroom, so he can't just look over you. And that's another issue we'll talk about hopefully later. That is, when you raise your hand and your hand is ignored, and you know, you take it and the teacher goes on to somebody else, and that was something that would happen on a common basis, on a regular basis, to the point that I realized that either I would accept it or I'd have to figure out a way, excuse me, my hand's been up or something else like that. So those are the first issues I had to deal with. Was I did not like being ignored, and then had to realize, well, how could I be ignored if I'm the only dark face in the room?
Right.
So what else is going on here? That's one of the early things I thought about. And that was, again, as an independent thinker, you didn't accept what was on the table. You had to have more understanding of what it is. I think one of my first big issues was the fact of being raised as a Catholic. I was told in second or third grade that the only people that went to heaven were those who were Christian Catholic. And there was a lot of Baptist people and non-Catholics in my community, good people. So I asked the nuns one day, if you had to be Catholic to go to heaven, what happens with all those other people who are not of our religion? And then she said, well, her answer was, they go to purgatory. Well, if they go to purgatory, how do they get into heaven? And, you know, she just got a little flustered and just said, you have to accept your faith that you were chosen to be Catholic, and you will get to heaven, whereas those other people won't. And that was the end of the conversation. And that did not answer the question for me.
Right, right. Well, you know, as we're talking, I'm thinking my path as a female, as a woman, had quite a number of similarities. You know, I couldn't hide that I was female. Well, I probably could have hidden it better, but I didn't. There was a whole question of, did you have any power, or weren't you supposed to have a place in the home, and keeping quiet and letting other people talk and not telling jokes and all the things that were assigned to women. I was born in the 40s, so I'm older than you, I believe. Here's one thing I found that I just want to ask you about. I've spent my life claiming my power, and the more fully I have claimed my power, the better my life has flowed. Have you found that true for yourself?
Yes. And that's where medicine was established to be the best profession for me, is because in medicine you have a set of skills that people come to you for your advice, for your knowledge. So you don't have to push people into understanding what's it about. You simply state, this is my experience, this is my knowledge set, and people go with you. And that was, again, another, as I'm looking at fields where I can be my own man, medicine was one of those places. In the book, I have one of my characters talking about the fact that men fear women all the way back down to Mary Magdalene, or the church, because instead of making Mary Magdalene a prostitute as opposed to the wife of Jesus, was one way of setting back the fact that she was an integral part. She, you know, had some power. And remember, again, that was another part of the whole eruption in 1970. It wasn't just a black discovery. Women were burning their bras.
Right.
Women were, you know, affirmative action had a whole bunch to do about equalizing the playing field for women as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that fact is again, when you're too big to hide, too dark to blend in, a lot of the focus goes on that, but goes on the person that's most recognizable. But affirmative action, I see it, and I know you see it too, was a huge break for all those frustrated women who were not being recognized as well.
Right, right. So I just want to pull this quote from your book because it illustrates what we've been talking about. You say, explored, he was learning more and more about race relations. And Steve says, I think he's Canadian, but barely. Shit, the Negro problem up here, this is in Canada, the Negro problem up here doesn't even involve Afro-Americans. The colored folks up here are the Native Americans, the Indians. I had a lady I was dating, and she was an Indian or First Nation, whatever. And Paul said, yeah, I guess everybody's got to have their, I guess everybody's got to have their niggers. And Steve replied, yeah, I hear in Asian countries it's the Koreans, and in Russia it's the Ukrainians, Great Britain the Irish, Eastern Canada the French Canadians. And you've already mentioned my husband Bob's family was Jewish, and he also had similar issues, though, as you pointed out, he could blend in better. So I remember having a race relations professor at the University of Washington who was from South Africa, and his theory was that we become prejudiced when there's distance between us, between people, that when we come closer together and get to know each other as people, there's not so much prejudice. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes, there was a book that was written by a gentleman by the name of Gordon Allport. I remember it in college well, and it was called The Nature of Prejudice. And he blamed it on the fact that we have a mindset that way before computers were popular, he said that our brains work like computers, where we put in the easiest answer for most situations, and if we can answer the immediate question by that preset knowledge, you don't go any further. And that's what prejudice is all about. It's built on very minimal amount of information that the person is comfortable with, and they move with it. The whole thing about having to have somebody lesser or to have someone beneath them is, again, this whole thing of it's okay to be ethnocentric and rise to the occasion above others. Again, it's a sound bite to move ahead of others, and it's a quick, dirty one, but again, it's built on faulty premises from lack of knowledge or information that you have on the people. But of course, when you live with people or you're exposed to more information, some of those changes have to be reorganized. And those of us who are involved in our emotions and trust our emotions, to use what I've, as I've been looking at these things for you, they can rise to a different level, away from where they are or where they were made. But it takes trusting your emotions to go that step further to question what is written and what you feel.
And so how would you say your protagonist, Paul, how did he trust his emotions? What were the things that he began to do to trust his emotions?
Well, he had the knowledge. People liked to talk to him, possibly educate him, and it was just about him opening up his ears and trusting who he was as an individual to come up to his own conclusions of whether he wanted to be with this person or would trust this person or not. So the creation, I never went to Vietnam. I was never a Marine. I was never a rock and roll star. We'll just set that. That's why this book is a fiction. But I wanted to create an individual who dealt with war, because that was 1970. That was a big ticket item at that point. Those people who went to Vietnam and came back from Vietnam scarred by all those things that they had to do to become a successful soldier and whatnot. And so I wanted my character to successfully have dealt with that, because a lot of people in that time had that saddle on their back. I wanted him to break away from some of the accepted comforts of the world. A good education is in Stanford University. He had a sweetheart that was educated and beautiful, and he had a job to look forward to, joining his father's practice. So all those things are situations that put a person over and above those of us who are struggling, trying to find an occupation, trying to find a way to a person that they want. I gave him all those things already there, and he had to create a dilemma to break away from that. And
yes,
his breakaway was going to Canada. I made him a musician because we look at musicians as individuals who can sit in the background and watch things go on and entertain people and not really be challenged if they want. I made him a medical person in the war, so I wouldn't have to deal with the fact of, you know, how did he come to terms with killing an individual. He didn't have to. He was healing people. He was helping people in the field, be there Viet Cong or wherever, or fellow soldiers. So he was, again, a helper. He was a part. He was trying to help the situation as opposed to being a part of the dilemma.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's why medical in the war. That's why a musician, before he truly finds that there's more to life than what he's doing.
And also, I just there is quite a bit, since he is a musician, there is quite a bit of conversation about music of the time, and I just want to look at for a moment that did at the time play a big role in people claiming who they were. Like Jimi Hendrix and Richie Havens were both mentioned, for example, and they were role models, but they also were able to express some of the issues through their music. Is that correct?
Jimi Hendrix, because he was just, again, a independent thinker and played his music the way he had to play it. Richie Havens was a very close friend to Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan was a exceptional poet. Peter, Paul, and Mary. Marvin Gaye, What's Going On?
Mm-hmm.
There was just the ball of confusion by the Temptations. People listened to musicians. People listened to poets, Allen Ginsberg, and others of the time who were just questioning, or again, the beat culture. From the beatnik era, again, I'm from San Francisco, poetry centers standing up on stage, just as what today is the kids who do their rap wars are there. So no, music has always been an integral part of telling the story. To people, black music, a lot of black music wasn't even considered until the Beatles from England came out and was singing black songs.
Yes.
And now they were listening to them. I mean, so, music, the musician has always been all the way back to the traveling minstrels.
Right.
And, way back is that's how people got the story of what was going on, as the musicians somehow were people who entertained. And if you had that second ear, that third eye, to what they were saying, it was more than just a nice, soothing melody. There was other messages going on.
Right.
So in the 70s, the people I mentioned all were telling their story. Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Something happening here, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
It was just a world of information that was exposed to us if you listened.
Thank you for explaining all that. We're up to our second break. My guest is orthopedic surgeon, African-American, and author, Dr. Mike Charles, who's author of Too Big to Hide, Too Dark to Blend In. We're talking about how to find your authentic self despite racial, social, religious, and class. Listening to Full Power Living. We'll be right back.
Difficult is it for you to ask directly for what you really want, to take responsibility graciously and willingly for your mistakes, or to relate with others because it's fun instead of because you need something from them? Most people believe manipulation and codependence are normal behaviors for adults. They may be common, but they're not normal. Manipulative behaviors really are designed to be part of childhood, to be put away as things of the past when we become adults. So, if you're ready to let manipulation and codependence be part of your past, then get the mini course I've created for you, Ending Codependence, The Bottom Line. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, offering you a formula that you can follow for creating healthy, manipulation-free, and lasting intimate relationships. I also give you the tools and principles that you can use to develop lasting immunity to codependence. Get Ending Codependence today at www.emotionalpro.com. That's emotionalpro.com.
Welcome back to Full Power Living. In case you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Dr. Michael Charles, who's author of Too Big to Hide, Too Dark to Blend In. Our toll-free number is 888-498-0570. You can talk directly with Dr. Charles about the racial climate of the 60s and 70s and how he found his way to a successful life
despite how he was seen by many others. And Mike, before we dive back in, where can people get copies of your new novel and or find out more about you?
I do have a website, www.drmikecharles, that's available. And the book is, from what I understand, all over. That is Amazon, Kindle, e-books, Barnes & Noble. So all that should, they're out and people are buying them. Like I said, it was 40 years in the making for me, so it can't come soon enough, but that's all there. But my website of drmikecharles.com is one place that is readily available.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. And I've now put that on the Emotional Pro chat, and we're going to ask our producer to put it on the Blog Talk chat, so you'll have that website. So now you already mentioned that that your protagonist Paul had a relationship with a woman named Monique, who was a political science professor, and I'd like this quote, so I just want to share it. Somehow Paul felt inconspicuous when he was with Monique. Well, truthfully, he would stand out in any crowd. Since he was 6'4", it made him too big to hide, and his Louisiana red-toned chocolate complexion made him too dark to blend with the predominantly white faces around them. But somehow he didn't feel on display with Monique. They were simply two people out and about. The people around him hadn't changed, so obviously it was a mindset shift on his part. Monique really made him feel they were the only people around. So, you know, one of the principles that I've learned in life and I use with my therapy clients, Mike, is that where you place your attention is where things increase, where they grow. So, what this pointed out to me was that a lot of Paul's attention had been going out to the outside world, like, what are they thinking about me? Where do I fit in with them? But when, through Monique, he started focusing inwardly on himself, he came home. He didn't have all the angst that he had before.
Correct. And, yeah. You know, I kind of set that up when Paul first goes into a pub in Canada, and he feels people looking at him, and he says, but it wasn't bad stares. He said, well, maybe they think I'm Sidney Poitier, or that was Sidney Poitier had just did the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. So that was the black face at the time that was most popular, and that's why I used it. But, you know, it also has to do, I was thinking about that question and that situation. It also has to do with the girlfriend before Monique did like to draw attention. And she would call people if they gave her dirty looks about being with a black person, and all of a sudden he would have to maybe be on guard to defend himself with it and things like that. Whereas this woman, she didn't have that type of personality. She seemed to not be distracted by other people's looks or anything else. It was more of a one-on-one situation. So that was part of the individual learning to be more comfortable with himself,
right,
and focusing on the individual that he was with, as opposed to looking for a fight or looking for the next challenge in the room.
Uh-huh.
So we have a couple of things going on there. Number one, this individual, the woman that he was with, helped him focus on the fact that, you know, you're with me, and I want all your attention to be given, to be put towards me, as opposed to a woman that he had just been with, is who's going to mess with us today?
You know, right.
Who are we going to have to set straight today?
Uh-huh.
And that would be added, of course, to the fact that she was with somebody who was very noticeable. So,
right.
So it was sort of a double paradox there, where this individual actually made him want to focus on just being with her, as opposed
right.
to the other individual who was actually adding coal to the fire by wanting some type of confrontation or interaction and things like that. And so he
yes.
was just trying to put it together, but he just was recognizing the fact that there was a difference in being in a relationship with this person as opposed to the last relationship that he had just left.
Right, right. And you, this is a quote of Paul coming to his understanding. Come to realize that wherever the road took him, the human experience was the same. No matter the color of their skin or what language they spoke, for everyone's life struggles are all similar. Being around and living comfortably with different ethnicities had to happen. In spite of governments controlling whatever they could, it was all about sharing and savoring the diversities as well as the commonalities. I thought that was a beautiful way of summing that up. And I just wanted to throw in here, I remember being in the operating room with my husband. I had the pleasure of being there when Bob operated on four different people, either their brain or their spine. And one of the outstanding things that I noticed was that once he cut through the skin, everybody was exactly the same color, that we're all alike. And this is, you know, I really related to Paul when he came to this conclusion, too. Look, we're all alike. We may have these small differences, but we're really the same. We are all human souls in human bodies.
Correct.
Yeah. So, you know, our time is closing in on us. I want to mention here that Paul manages to get a mentor, Dr. Dixon. He gets into medical school, and like you, he becomes an orthopedic surgeon. And, you know, as you've told us, his approach is unorthodox. But in a way, his result is super mainstream. He's a doctor, for goodness sake, and a specialist. But it's what's right for him. And one of the things that I thought of when I was looking at that is one of my children never finished high school. He never finished 4 years of college. Yet this child in his or her life has made a higher income than any other of my five children children that I've had a part in raising. So you don't have to be the same as in order to be successful. What you really have to do is be solidly yourself. And,
and that's what Dr. Christian said. It's okay to be an independent thinker, but understand the fact that if by being an independent thinker, you're thinking out of the box. By thinking out of the box, you may be bringing something new to the table. And that can be marketable. That can be used to your advantage. And that's what we're talking about. There's many issues, but the thing is, just because you don't think or look at things the same, it doesn't mean that you're weird or different. If you can corral those feelings and emotions and put them into a perspective that other people may have not thought about, or you're making them now come to surface and act on.
Right. Well, you know,
I'm glad you stuck with this for 40 years, Mike, because you do have a unique perspective, and you're able to bring out the history and the issues and the ideas about how to be successful regardless of what stereotypes or what circumstances you may have in your life, that you need to keep connected with yourself and your own emotions. You need to keep your eye on the ball. You need to connect with other people and allow people to help you and give you a leg up. There are a lot of things that you bring out in this book that are really, really important for us to consider. And you looked at them within the fabric of the American culture and then also contrasted it with other cultures. And you've addressed it on both a world issue level and as a personal issue. So I just think you've done a really good job in bringing these out. It's not an easy thing to do, but I want to thank you for writing Too Big to Hide, Too Dark to Blend In, and also for being here on Full Power Living today.
Oh, thank you so much. This is, by the way, the book was just published June 1st last month, so this is my first exposure to the world. Thank you, Eileen.
My pleasure. Well, that was our deal. I will tell my listeners, Mike, that you gave a brilliant talk at my husband's memorial service in January, and at that point you and I agreed that when your book came out, we'd put you on the air, and it's been a pleasure to be able to follow up and keep that commitment.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for the talk, too.
We had so much fun talking to each other. We didn't even get a chance to open it up, so maybe another time.
All right. That's good. So join us live every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific time, noon Eastern, for more powerful experiences on Full Power Living, including next Thursday when my guest is Maureen St. Germain, who's inviting us all to connect with our own higher self and giving us tools to do so. Listen next Thursday to this show on our archives and invite your friends and family to listen with you. Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media is our producer. Thank you, Paul. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.